KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I am at Hit Record somewhere in Los Angeles with a man who's made, 40 movies since 1992? Basically a movie every 2 years, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He's here to talk about his new film, his first feature as writer, director, star. Don John, thanks so much for doing this, first of all.
Thanks for being here, man.
It's funny because I think about so many things you've done that some of your directors have been here. We've had Kimberly Pierce, Scott Frank's been here, Chris Nolan's been here a few times, certainly Ryan Johnson. Mm-hmm. And some of these things you've done, you play characters who are kind of obsessed with something.
Uh-huh.
These guys who are obsessed with trying to find a way into like a normal, or what they feel would be a normal society, seems to be kind of a sweet spot for you as an actor.
That's funny, man. I haven't put that together before, but I see what you're saying. And maybe that is something that I personally share. I do feel very strongly towards, in particular, you know, the work that I do. And I get, you use the word obsessed. Maybe I do get obsessed or incredibly focused. I don't do much else. I think any great character is going to have a really specific drive or desire. I mean, the cliche is an actor saying, what's my motivation? If you don't have something really specific going on like that, then it's not going to make an interesting scene or story.
But it's even you find a way to use it in comedy. And that these guys he played in comedies, I mean, I think about 500 Days of Summer, and that's sort of to me like, Every Breath You Take, this guy, if you go the wrong way, he's a horrible guy. I mean, mm-hmm. but it's the same kind of obsession to make this girl love him. Mm-hmm. That if you could just look at it just a little bit under the surface, he's not a romantic character in the classic sense.
I completely agree with you, man. The character in 500 Days of Summer that I played, I think, is often sort of misperceived. And that's because, in my opinion, the movie's told very much from his point of view. It's not objective, it's subjective. There's a narrator in the movie who sounds objective because he has this sort of authoritative, deep man's voice, but he's wrong more often than he's right, the narrator is. And the truth is that character, Tom, I think he's sort of selfish, and he's projecting his ideas of what a love is onto a person and not really connecting with who that person is. And honestly, that's very similar to the character in Don John. Obviously, John has a very different style than Tom in 500 Days of Summer. Tom plays more does the sort of sensitive puppy dog shtick, whereas John does more the alpha dog shtick. But just underneath that thin veneer, I think both of them at the start of the story are sort of selfish dudes. And by the end, hopefully they begin to grow up a bit and change course.
I have to ask you the money question. So what's Don John about, Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
Don John, to sum it up, I would say it's sort of about how media influences us to treat people more like things than like people. And it's about that one-way street, that rather than connecting with somebody and really embracing that unique individual and the unique moment that you find yourselves in, instead, comparing what's in front of you to some preconceived expectations, oftentimes expectations that you've learned from different kinds of media. So you have this character, John, who is constantly comparing the women in his life to what he likes in pornography videos. And then there's a connection drawn between, you know, his relationship to his media and the character that Scarlett Johansson plays, Barbara. She watches too many romantic Hollywood movies, and so she has her equally kind of skewed perspective on life and the world and love and sex and relationships that she's learned from her media of choice. So it's a comedy of errors, I guess, in that way. That, you know, you're doomed to disappointment because real life is not as simple as what you see on a two-dimensional screen. Even the best movie in the world, and I love movies, but even the best movies, they can't compare it to real life. It's just a different thing. One is a finite work of art, and one is a whole life, which I guess is finite and sort of a work of art. But aside from that, You know, they don't map over each other. And if you're constantly making those comparisons, you're going to end up like John and Barbara.
Why don't you change the title? When I saw the Sundance, it was Don John's Addiction.
Right.
I mean, he's addicted to something. I don't want to give too much of the movie away. Let's say he's addicted to porn. But
sure.
But his real addiction seems to be trying to define himself as a man.
I think that's exactly it. Well, I mean, look, first of all, it's shorter. I think shorter titles are better. That's, to be honest, a big part of the reason. But also, yeah, I think people were... I found this because we didn't have a chance to do like test screenings or anything. This is a low budget movie. We can't afford to, you know, rent out a theater and have a test screening. So our test screenings were the festival circuit, you know, Sundance and South By and Berlin, et cetera. And I found that at Sundance and South By, et cetera, people were taking that word addiction literally and saying, so you've made a movie about porn addiction. I was like, oh man, that's really not what I wanted to make a movie about at all. And I don't think the movie is about that. An analogy I made is, you know, The Maltese Falcon is not a movie about a statue of a bird. Certainly that bird is in there the whole time, and the last shot of the movie is a shot of the statue, and, you know, everyone's talking about it, everyone's after it, but that's not what the movie's about. And same kind of thing, you know, the Don John is not a movie about how much pornography this guy watches, but that is a central symbol that represents his sort of one-way street, his disconnection with everything in his life. Certainly the women in his life, but also his family, his friends, his church, his own body.
You have to talk about the movies that are in the movie, which are kind of wonderful.
There's a sequence where John and Barbara, that's me and Scarlett, we go to the movies. She wants to go on a, you know, bring her date to the movies, and we go see this, you know, sort of spoof romantic comedy.
It and seems a horrible, plausible. I mean, it seems like you've seen that movie before.
Of course you have, yeah.
You've probably been offered that movie before.
Those movies get churned out like clockwork, and there's a reason. And the reason is they make a lot of money. That's actually the reason. Well, and I guess the reason they make a lot of money is because lots of people like them. And look, I'm not saying that's bad.
Yeah, you are, but that's okay.
I don't know if I'm saying that's
bad. Well, because like, those movies are basically about selling something. And the whole, it's, to some extent, people want to be these things that they see in other places. He wants to be like his dog, the guy he hangs out with. She wants to be like these things she sees in the movie. And neither of them are really connecting on any kind of personal level.
But there's a difference between saying the movie is bad itself and developing those expectations from the movie. I think it depends on how you choose to watch a movie. I can enjoy a dumb romance movie or a dumb action movie or, like, you know, just have a good time at, I shouldn't say dumb, at a simple, you know, formulaic movie. They can be really fun. We can all enjoy them. It's when you start seeing those movies to the exclusion of other movies and then start believing that real life is supposed to be that way. That's, I think, where the problem comes in.
It's the treatment the guy I'm arguing with calls himself Regular Joe, if you read the tiny stories. But it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt. His first film he wrote, directed, and starred in is Don John. But I feel like you're saying something in this movie about the kinds of things that people buy into and objectification for both men and women.
That's exactly right. Well, that was the heart of it, is I think I grew up as an actor working on TV and movies, and so I've always paid a lot of attention to the way media influences how we see the world.
And you've fought that basically in a lot of ways your entire career, haven't you?
Well, I think there are problems with it. I also love it. Look, the movies and the TV shows and stuff that I watch are very meaningful to me and a big part of how I make sense of my life and the world. So I don't think there's anything bad, certainly, about movies, or I wouldn't spend my life dedicated to them. But I do take issue with some of the ways that our culture positions movies and the people, and especially actors in movies, when they get treated like royalty and stuff. I think that's weird and not the point.
But also there seems to be, certainly in Don John, you're taking kind of a jaundiced view of commodification, the way he kind of speaks to the culture and asks you to become something that's not really you.
Well, that's exactly right. So both my character and Scarlett's character are very intent on fitting into these molds of masculinity and femininity. And I think we all have that tendency within us to want to fit in. And some of us are more a slave to that, and some of us find our independence and embrace our unique individuality. And me, I know I've got a balance of both within me. And I think most people do. You know, John and Barbara are very much sort of find themselves confined, whether they know it or not. And then there's the character that Julianne Moore plays, and she's kind of the opposite. She just does not care. She's just really honest and really kind of present, and even to a fault. And so when you put a character like her next to a character like John, it's, first of all, it's funny. And then second of all, you know, hopefully both of them can learn something from the other.
Yeah, and there's a point in the movie, it's almost a crisis point, where he stops looking at himself in the mirror in the same way. Mm-hmm. He kind of feel like that John has absorbed something from her.
That's just it. Yeah, well, it's a coming-of-age story, you know, as they say. Like, one of my favorite movies, and one movie that that I would compare it to, is Shampoo, the Hal Ashby movie.
Sure.
Where you have this sort of Don Juan-type character that Warren Beatty plays, and he's charming, but he's got his faults for sure, and he's selfish, treats people more like things than like people. By the end, you know, once he's gone through the trials and tribulations of the story, you do see him just beginning to maybe start to break out of that. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want the ending to be like, and then he was a whole new person and, you know, everyone lived happily ever after. I like to be optimistic and think that people can change, but I also think that's a gradual process and nothing happens overnight. So at the end of this movie, I hope you see the beginnings of an evolution for our hero.
Well, you said Shampoo, but I guess I found myself thinking more about Carnal Knowledge.
I like that movie too, the Mike Nichols movie. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Because it uses sex in the same way.
Early Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. And he basically sort of treats women as these things he's collecting. And sure. Sex is, once it's over, he has nothing really to do or doesn't know how to talk to these women. And that for me, and I wonder if that was a movie that you looked at as well for this.
I did, actually. That's funny you bring it up, because it was, I didn't know about it.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I knew who Mike Nichols was from The Graduate, et cetera, but I just watched it pretty recently, a couple of years ago, while I was writing the script, Carnal Knowledge. And I also love the honesty in it. I feel like a lot of movies, they sort of dance around how men and women talk about each other. And in Carnal Knowledge, it's really honest and therefore funny. And I wanted to bring that kind of honesty to Don John.
But also, too, what's funny about this movie, and it feels like something you've gotten from me, the writer-directors you work with, you work mostly with writer-directors, interestingly enough, and I want to get to that, too, is none of the comedy stuff is played for comedy. I mean, you play it as real and fast as possible.
I mean, look, I love a good farcical comedy as well, and that's what we would do on Third Rock from the Sun. But I also really love the comedies where the humor is coming from your connection to the people in the story. It was actually while I was shooting 50-50 that I first had this sort of comic take occur to me. But I was trying to think of how to frame the movie, what tone it should be, what structure it should take. And it was while I was shooting 50-50, which is same thing. It's a comedy. It's really funny, but it's not from gags. It's
behavior.
It's from behavior. Yeah, situations and people and relating to how the people feel. And also what I liked about 50-50 is it's honest. You know, it means it's rated R, because if you want to talk how people really talk, you're going to get an R rating. So I said, well, okay, so what if I did that? If I made it a comedy, took the R rating, then everybody can talk the way everyone really talks and make it funny.
But Third Rock is also really subversive farce. I mean, it's really attacking all these things that the movie attacks.
You're right. Human conventions, I guess.
Yeah, but also, I mean, those characters, those aliens, were obsessed with fitting in. They were this cartoon version of what human beings were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost funny that you could extrapolate from that to Don John, where they're two-dimensional versions of what people should be, because they learn from watching all these other things the way the characters on Third Rock did.
That's a funny connection, man. I hadn't thought of that before, but that's really true. If you're too obsessed, like you say, with external influences, and you're never looking inward, yeah, you're going to end up sort of, well, disappointed.
But as we talk about those, I think because the movie has so much energy, I wonder as a director how you're able to give that sense of momentum, because it doesn't stop or even slow down until you meet Julianne Moore's character, and then it becomes another movie.
Uh-huh. I wanted the style to really reflect the evolution of the character. A lot of comedies especially sort of stay pretty conservative with their camera and edit and music and things like that. And I get that as a choice, because it just puts the focus on.
But even that, to that extent, you were very specific about giving this movie a look, which
absolutely
comedies often don't have.
You're right. I really wanted to do that. While I was writing it, I kept coming up with, oh, you know what would be cool right here is if the camera was doing this, or if we did this with the editing, or that with the music. And so much goes into a movie. And again, this is a movie sort of about movies. And so I wanted to play with those tropes, that vocabulary, and the movie itself sort of makes itself guilty of a lot of the things it criticizes. I like stuff like that. Like Godard does that, just to throw out some
name of some famous director who makes movies about really about pop culture,
yeah,
and about our love for pop culture and about people falling in love with those images.
I got self-conscious for making a Godard.
This is public radio. We do it all the time here. Yes, please. You can't swear, but you can go as high as you want to go.
Glad to know it.
But that's funny to hear you say that, because there's that kind of trippy, speedy quality. If you think about the original Breathless, that has that kind of role, and you can see how these people want to be these things that they've been watching all the time.
Sure, and he's looking at that poster of Bogart, and then you've got those same shots with the silhouette and the hat and the suit, and you know, the movie itself definitely, it's self-referential in that way. So we do a lot of the same things where the movie itself sort of objectifies my character, Scarlett's character, you know, when she's walking up in slow motion and the violins swell and the steady cam is, you know, going behind us and the lights flare in the background as we're kissing and stuff like that. I mean, it's funny. I think it's a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, I wanted to actually lure the audience into feeling those feelings that those tropes are designed to elicit. On the other hand, I also wanted, hopefully, the audience to become aware of, like, oh, look, this is kind of manipulative. You know, this isn't how real life is.
Well, my guess, who's the first person in the history of this show to be self-conscious about saying Jean-Luc Godard, is Joseph Gordon-Levitt. His new film, first as writer, director, star, is Don John. It's The Treatment. We'll take a break. More after this.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment. KCRW is a nonprofit public radio station. We thrive on the support of listeners like you. Make a donation at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to The Treatment. My guest, who can't stand Jean-Luc Godard, is Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He likes those shallow movies that he's done, like Hesher and Brick, and all those movies that just make you feel better about yourself as a human being. His first film as writer, director, star is Don John. But it's you got a movie that's got movies in it that have movie moments in the movies that you show.
You're right.
And also you're evoking these movie moments as a filmmaker. Because people do fall in love with the movies, and the movies Godard was so aware of dictate the way we dress and the way we talk and the way we think about ourselves.
Sure.
And that was all stuff. That's why I was saying, in stylistic terms, you took a really big bite out of the apple for this movie.
Well, thanks. If I was going to write and direct a movie, I wanted to take a big swing. I wanted to do something bold and maybe a little risky and provocative and try to, you know, say something that I feel really strongly about. You know, some people advise me, maybe do that next movie, you know. Maybe
really?
For your
Why
first
are you saying that?
Well, because it's risky. And for your first movie, just, you know, make something just a little safer. Make something that's just going to be good and solid. And that didn't interest me, which isn't to say that I won't do that in the future. Because, like I said, I enjoy a lot of movies like that. There's times where I really want to watch a movie where, like, I know what I'm going to get, and I get it, and it delivers it, and it delivers it well. Great. I don't always want to watch some artist's passionate
statement.
Communication about what they think, you know. I don't always want to watch that, but oftentimes I do, and well, that's what this is.
But the thing that I wanted to talk to you about in this film, and I was really wondering where it came from, is that there's a love of movies in it. You're talking about passion in the first part of the show, but that love of film, when did that first stir in you?
Oh, man. Probably before I even remember, I always really loved watching movies.
Do you remember what the movies were as a kid that just really made you think, wow?
I just answered this question yesterday, so I have it fresh in my mind.
I'm here to re-ask you stuff. So
yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. I remember watching Dumbo when I was a kid, and I've rewatched it recently. It holds up. Like, it's a really brilliant movie, aside for some, there is some pretty overt racism towards the end.
Tell me more about this racism of which you speak. Perhaps the crows you
made. Well, there are these crow characters that are, it's perpetrating stereotypes that seem like they're more from the 19th century.
But you were saying that the movies, it obviously had this kind of transportative effect on you, didn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember having such a powerful emotional connection to that movie. I remember laughing and crying.
And being terrified.
Yeah.
Which is what Disney movies, fairy tale movies used to do. They go back to Grimm's fairy tales. Mm-hmm. At a certain point, every one of those kind of primal Disney movies about the fear of losing your parents.
Sure, yeah. And that's, I mean, that scene where his mom's in jail and he goes to visit her, and there's that song, Baby Mine. I mean, I don't think there's any movie scene that I have a stronger emotional connection to than that one. It's it's so well done and so beautiful. But I also love the Pink Elephants song, which is incredibly psychedelic and like imaginative, and you know, in the middle of this children's movie.
That way that you're talking about the movie, it just unlocks these things in your head.
Yeah.
Sort of like animation or Dr. Seuss or any of that kind of stuff can do.
Love
as a
Dr.
kid.
Dr. Seuss.
Okay, this yeah. is exactly the same thing. It mm-hmm. just takes you places, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Sure.
What was the first time you were in a movie you were conscious of that? I mean, because you go back to Angels in the Outfield, your first time
sure.
with Tony Danza.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now this is our grand reunion, 20 years.
What was it like when you met him? Do you remember that, meeting him? Because he was a big star when you met, TV star. Then.
Sure, well, and we worked every day together in a baseball stadium. And, you know, at the...
What'd you shoot?
Where the Oakland A's play.
Oh.
The Oakland Coliseum. We had a blast. We made friends even back then. And we would... we were both skaters. We both had our rollerblades. And we would skate around the stadium. They had this, like, perfect polished concrete in the walkways of the stadium. We would skate all around. I remember that.
What was it like to cast him?
Well, he was the first person. Once I started to think of, okay, who should play this... He was the first person I thought of. I think he was the perfect idea because Tony is so naturally lovable. When you see him on screen, you can't help but smile and like him. And that's because he has truly such a warm heart. That guy does. He really does. But the character that he plays in Don John is charming, but not exactly lovable. He's selfish. He has a short temper. He's sort of lecherous. I wanted to have this apparent because while the main thrust of the movie is how media sometimes leads us to treat people more like things and like people, you can never just attribute it to media, I don't think. So I wanted to show what else is going on in the protagonist's life that made him this way. So the family features quite prominently in the movie.
And it's, to me, it just gets to all these things about, again, it's a big bite of the apple. There are a lot of things you do in the movie. And in the first act, there's a kind of compression. Everything is really heightened. Mm-hmm. He feels like this guy who's living in his head the movie of his life.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of flash in it. There are a lot of colors in it. There's a lot of... It's almost like watching the trailer of his life in his head. Isn't
That's
it?
Well put, and that is what we were going for. We our references were like MTV and Michael Bay, and you know, let's move the camera a lot real quick. Let's cut a lot. The music is all made out of sort of these big shiny synth sounds, and then in the second act, he develops this conventional romance with a girlfriend, doing sort of what he's supposed to do. And so the movie starts feeling like a conventional Hollywood romantic movie, and the camera starts being on dollies and moving very gently, and the editing, you know, starts going along with the traditional Hollywood rules of editing.
But still a really sort of heightened color scheme and lighting scheme in that second part of the film.
Well, yeah, I mean, traditional Hollywood romantic movies are heightened. They're not real. They're glossy, and that's when we shot it really glossy. The music is all, you know, these lush strings and orchestral arrangements. And then in the third act, when he's sort of starting to break out of his mold and try to connect with what's in front of his face, we wanted to take a more organic approach. So there's a lot less cutting. The shots go on for longer. The camera's generally handheld and not doing these big, quick moves, but sort of simple and sparse. And the music also really pares down to stuff that's arranged just for a few guitars.
You must have shown the script to Ryan Johnson and Chris Nolan. What did they say about it?
Ryan was the first guy I showed my first finished draft to. And he was really encouraging. It was a it was a big turning point for me because up to that point, I'd just been writing alone. I mean, I'd had the idea in my head for years at that point. It had been probably about 1 year that I'd been writing it in full-on screenplay form. You know, I was doing it in my spare time. I have screenwriter friends who get hired, and in 2 months, they'll, you know,
bang
write
a draft. Sure.
Yeah. So this was not that. This was when I had a few hours free, I would sit down and just enjoy myself, really, and have fun writing a scene.
Did it feel like kind of an oasis for you a little bit? Because it was such a different discipline from anything else you do.
Absolutely. It was something I was doing, I think, for the fun of it as much as anything else. And it's fun working on something alone. You know, working on sets, it's also fun, obviously, working with tons of people. But taking a break and just working on something that's just me in my own head, was fun. But that's a double-edged sword, because when you're alone, you don't have anybody to feed back off of, and you get those voices in your head saying, like, you should just quit. You don't need to do this. You know, other people will do this better than you.
How did you deal with those voices?
I would just sort of say, okay, voices, well, I'm having a good time anyway, so let me do my thing. I don't care.
But in almost all these movies that you've done, in so many of them, loneliness becomes a part of it. Mm. And in that third act of Don John, the third act of almost all these movies, except with the exception of Brick, where he sort of starts himself being a lonely guy, but he still wants to connect. Mm-hmm. That trying to find a way to play loneliness is something that you're really gifted at doing, I think.
Well, thank you.
I mean, just these guys just realize that they're alone for the first time in some sort of key way.
What's that line, all alone is all we are?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that something we all feel? I mean, that's being a person, I think. To some degree, we are alone. We never get to be anybody else.
But movies often romanticize that. And the way you play these in so many of these movies is it's not a romantic state. I mean, it's really kind of awful.
Can be. It can be. But there's also I also really value solitude. In fact, speaking of Ryan Johnson, I remember he gave me this book, Letters to a Young Poet, the Rilke book.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And one of the things I took from that book was about solitude and how valuable that is. And if you know, the older poet is writing to the younger poet, you have to, I forget the exact words, but you know, you have to go into your solitude. You have to embrace
there
that.
Is, yeah.
You know, go way, way down deep into it where no learn, one else
you
is.
You have to learn to love it. That's what he's talking about.
Uh-huh. And find that within yourself. And actually, I think, you know, to bring it back to Don John, that's sort of what he never does. Even when he's alone in a room, he's not looking into himself. He's always looking externally for, you know, whether it's from a pornography video or a Carl's Jr. commercial or something his dad thinks or something his friends think or, you know, or the mirror, you know. It's all quite external. And hopefully by the end, he is beginning to internalize a bit more and look inward, because he's now beginning to form this friendship with a character that Julianne Moore plays, who clearly does that a lot.
And we're out of time. Thanks so much for doing this, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest was not self-conscious about dropping Rilke in the second half of the show.
No, I learned.
It's Joseph Gordon-Levitt. His feature film debut as writer, director, and star is Don John. A recording engineer here in the middle of nowhere at Hit Record is Will Bentley. The show is mixed by Melissa Morden. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.